FM HD3 Urbana.
Greetings. It is January 8th, 2012, here on Media Matters, WILL AM 580. Happy New Year, everyone. We've got a great show for you today. The last 3 years have seen the economy collapse and struggle under the weight of deregulation and wild speculation and arguably illegal activity by those at the very top. And the main social movement initially to come out of this was one that said what we need to do is give those at the top even more privileges and worship them even more. Today we have the chronicler of that movement, Thomas Frank, here to talk about his new book, Pity the Billionaire, for the full hour. Hope you'll join us for the show today, but before we get to our guests, let's go to Media Minutes.
Any views or opinions expressed by the hosts of Media Minutes are their own and do not necessarily reflect those of this station, its management, or licensee.
Welcome to Media Minutes. I'm Stevie Converse.
And I'm Candace Clement.
And I'm Megan Tatey. Media scholar Robert McChesney called the book a masterpiece. Bill Moyer said it was a highly readable and engrossing story. And Malkia Cyril of the Center for Media Justice deemed it haunting and prophetic. Think they're reviewing the latest Stephen King novel? Hardly. The nonfiction book News for All the People, The Epic Story of Race and the American Media, has been garnering interest and accolades since Verso published it last October. The book made it to the New York Times bestseller list in November. Co-authored by Free Press's Joseph Torres and Democracy Now! Co-host Juan Gonzalez, News for All the People puts race at the center of the story of American media. Looking at everything from the first colonial newspaper to today's internet era, the book explores how people of color have fought for fair and just treatment from the mainstream media and are still fighting for it today. Torres said many people are unaware of the mainstream media's shameful history.
Media owners have used their properties to target and to incite violence against people of color. We give at least a dozen examples in the book of how the newspapers incited violence against the African-American community or the Mexican-American community, and it resulted in hangings and resulted in massacres in those cities and killings in different cities across the country. So media has played a tragic role too often in harming people of color.
The book unearths both the corporate battles and the government policies that built a highly segregated and consolidated media system. Today, people of color own only a small percentage of newspapers and radio and TV stations, and the mainstream media often misrepresents and stereotypes people of color in both news and entertainment programming.
We want to educate our fellow journalists, not just journalists of color, but other journalists, too, that media policy matters. This is a First Amendment issue, and consolidation impacts the quality of news.
Torres and Gonzalez worked on the book for 7 years.
We just became motivated by the material, just all the different heroes who have fought for a just media system and also all the tragic examples. It really showed that the issues we're dealing with today, there's nothing new about it. There's nothing new about the fight for a just media system. It's been something that people have been fighting for 200 years. We're still very much motivated on trying to get more people involved in holding media companies accountable and also making sure that the laws Congress passed and the FCC represent a public good. And we also want to get more people of color involved in that discussion and debate as well. So that kept us going.
Torres said the latest battle for media justice involves protecting the open internet from corporate gatekeepers so that people of color are free to tell their own stories online. To learn more about News for All the People, visit versobooks.com.
Women comprise 51% of the population, but own only 6% of all radio and TV station licenses. Such a small presence means women have little control over what gets on the airwaves. As a result, women's perspectives are often left out of the picture and ignored in public debates and policy decisions.
It's clear that if there isn't some link to those who see the value in those products or ideas or stories, then we won't see them. Those stories will disappear. We won't get that diversity.
Shireen Mitchell is the vice chair of the National Council of Women's Organizations, a 25-year-old nonpartisan network of over 240 organizations representing more than 12 million women. She's also the chair of NCWO's Media and Technology Task Force. She says that until recently, technology was not seen as a women's issue.
Time has definitely progressed to show us that women not involved in technology not only keeps them out of media opportunities, But now that we're also our own media broadcasters in so many ways with social media, it's a huge disadvantage.
NICWO recently released the first major women's media policy statement to come out in decades. The new policy has three key directives: to support women-centered media enterprises, to urge funders and investors to build the infrastructure necessary to ensure vibrant women's media, and to pressure the Federal Communications Commission to strengthen its equal opportunity policies and broaden women's ownership opportunities.
We're bringing the groups together, telling our members what they should be paying attention to, one, where they should comment, and two, where they should show up for hearings. And we're going to go back to also doing briefings and hearings and be more direct about making sure that these issues are being addressed and the policies that we feel are not even being implemented or just being ignored and overlooked, that we're going to be here to say, look, change has to happen in these areas.
Last month, NICWO and more than 50 other groups sent a letter to the FCC that urges the agency to evaluate the impact of its media ownership rules on opportunities for women and people of color. For more information, go to womensorganizations.org. You've been listening to Media Minutes, a production of Free Press, a national nonpartisan organization working to reform the media. For more information, visit freepress.net.
Okie dokie, welcome back to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, coming to you live today, our first show, or our second show, but our first live show of 2012 on this January 8th here in WILL AM 580. Our guest today, someone who's been our guest many times in the past, and it's an honor for me to welcome him back today. Tom Frank is the author of numerous books, including What's the Matter with Kansas, The Wrecking Crew, The Conquest of Cool, One Market Under God, and now he has a new book out, Pity the Billionaire, The Hard Time Swindle and the Unlikely Comeback of the Right, published by Metropolitan Books in this fair year of 2012. Tom Frank joins us today on the phone lines. Tom, welcome to Media Matters.
How are you today, Bob?
I'm doing great, thanks, and congratulations on the new book.
Thank you.
And
it's exciting, you know. It's I'm watching Romney and Santorum on TV, and I feel like I finally got the timing right on something.
Oh, I think your sense of timing's actually been pretty good. If your only problem oftentimes is when you're ahead of your time, and that's not a bad problem to have.
Yeah.
Well, let's talk about the book, and then we'll get into the presidential race later in the show. But let's start with Pity the Billionaire, The Hard Time Swindle, and The Unlikely Comeback of the Right. Why did you want to write the book, and what's it about?
It's about hard times conservatism. It's about the idea of our great reaction to the economic collapse of 2008 and 2009. I mean, the most spectacular response there has been this sort of incredible resurgence of the right. The Republican Party itself moved way to the right. You had the Tea Party movement, and then you had these sort of tremendous political victories in 2010. And all of that struck me as, well, I mean, it struck a lot of people as, this amazing contradiction of the usual historical pattern. You have a financial crisis that's very similar to 1929. You have this recession unfolding that's really, really bad. I mean, it's the worst we've had since the Great Depression. But our response is to do exactly the opposite. Sometimes, with the language just completely reversed, and that is an astonishing thing. Not just in a political sense, not just in an economic sense, but also in a cultural sense. And I'm trying to make sense out of it.
Do you really? I mean, I've thought about this a lot too. And as I was reading your book, but for my own work and my own thinking, it's a common theme in the show. You look at the 2010 elections, and it's presented as a tremendous victory of the political right. And obviously, in one sense, the Republicans won all these elections and they ran on a very right-wing platform that you describe in Pity the Billionaire. But the other side of the coin was that the voting turnout plummeted. Basically, no Democrat, far fewer Democrats voted and all the Republicans voted. But did that many people change their opinion between 2008 and 2010?
Oh, gosh. I don't know the answer to that. And that's probably true, what you say. I generally speaking, I don't look into things like that. I don't go into the sort of nuts and bolts of how the elections are gamed. Mm-hmm. I mean, these guys are, you and I both know, the conservative movement is really, really good at playing the political game. They do a great job. And it wouldn't surprise me at all that they were the lower turnout was sort of magnified their voice. That would not be a surprise to me. But whether they won that way or whether they won another way, this is still what happened. Mm-hmm. I'm trying to tell the story of how they pulled this off, how they made this appeal, and why so many people buy it. And by the way, it's going on again before our eyes in the primary states right now.
How so?
I mean the candidates chasing one another to the right. I don't mean the low turnout. I mean the candidates. Oh. Although there's that too. I mean Iowa caucuses are famous for that. But the candidates chasing one another to the right. And you have here's what I'm writing about for Harper's this month. The candidates basically using Andrew Mellon's famous advice to Herbert Hoover. Liquidate the farmers, liquidate labor, let the homeowners, let everybody go down, let everybody lose their shirts, which historians have traditionally regarded as some of the worst economic advice ever. And there's several different Republican candidates are basically, that's the platform they're running on right now.
And as you talk about Tom Franke and Peter the Billionaire, this is presented as a populist approach
yeah.
to...
Yes.
Destroy the living standards of the bulk of the population is a populist moving into the man.
Yeah, well, that's how they sell it, and when you put it that way, and after what I just said about Andrew Mellon, who was of course one of the richest men in America and the spokesman for his class as well as the Secretary of the Treasury, those two things don't really go together, populism and Andrew Mellon, and nevertheless it is happening. I mean, I've been to these Tea Party rallies. I've seen it with my own eyes. Glenn Beck, his 9/12 project. It is for real. It's really happening. Now we can go to the details about who actually goes to the Tea Party rallies, and because that's kind of an interesting story. But the fact is that on the surface, all of this stuff is presented as being very populist.
Our guest today, Tom Franke, author of the brand new book, Pity the Billionaire, The Hard Time Swindle and the Unlikely Comeback of the Right, just published by Metropolitan Books. Tom Franke writes for Harper's Magazine, author of numerous other books, including The Conquest of Cool, One Market Under God, What's the Matter with Kansas, and The Wrecking Crew. This is his newest book. If you'd like to call in with a question or comment for Tom Franke here at Media Matters, the phone number is 217-333-9455, our toll-free number 1-800-222-9455, and the phone lines are open, so call in if you'd like to. Tom, as always, the book, absolute pleasure to read. I sat down and read it in one sitting the day it arrived at my house last month. And, one of the things that's interesting is you go through the birth of the Tea Party and then the origins and the nature of it. And there was a lot of material I sort of knew, but I didn't quite know. And I think you've become sort of the reigning expert on this turf now. I guess that's your take with you going forward.
I don't particularly want to be the reigning.
No, I'm sure you'd like to have this become a historical study sooner rather than later. One of the things that's interesting is, where does the Tea Party come from and who's in it? Start with where it came from, because the origins speak volumes about some of the weirdness of it.
Yeah, yes. I mean, everything that we've come to know it, all the things that it stands for and all the sort of the paradoxes of it, the ironies of it, were basically present at the creation. And it very famously started with a TV rant from CNBC commentator Rick Santelli, okay, and he reports for CNBC, which is the stock market channel. He reports for them from the floor of the Chicago Board of Trade. That's his beat. That's his job. And he was there doing his reporting one day, and he got all upset at what someone was saying. They were talking about the bailouts. This is in the early part of 2009, so the first weeks of the Obama presidency. And the bailouts, remember, President Obama inherited the bailouts from Bush and decided that, and was going to keep them going, continue the bailout policy of the Bush administration. And here's Rick Santelli on the floor of the Chicago Board of Trade, and he gets really furious, and he's yelling about this. And behind him, there's a floor full of traders, bond traders, derivative traders, that sort of thing. And they're I mean, futures traders is more likely what it is, futures and derivatives. And they start cheering for him. You know, they think he's really wonderful. And this becomes what they call, you know, is one of those first viral videos. Somebody turns it into a YouTube snippet, and it starts getting emailed around. And within a couple of days, everybody has seen it. And the Tea Party movement starts soon afterwards, because in his rant, Rick Santelli says he's going to, you know, to show his displeasure with the bailouts, he's going to call for a Chicago Tea Party, you know, like a Boston Tea Party, but he's going to call for that and to protest, you know, the bailouts. And there's two really important things worth noting about this. The first is that this populist movement actually literally has its origins on the floor of the Chicago Board of Trade, which is, you know, in terms of historical populism, is the most unlikely scenario. The original populists hated and despised and feared the Chicago Board of Trade. It was like, for them, in the 1890s, that's like the locus of evil. That's the most sinister place in the world. You know, the derivatives, the futures traders in Chicago, who rip off the farmers on the one side and the consumers on the other, you know, and who do nothing, produce nothing, you know, or just complete parasites on the, you know, on the farmers, the working population of this country. But this populist movement actually started on the Chicago Board of Trade. And the second thing is that I think Rick Santelli is pretty much against bailouts across the board, you know, as a lot of sort of free market purists are, or were anyways. But the particular part of the bailout package that he was objecting to on that day was the part that was supposed to help borrowers who were facing foreclosure. You know, there's lots of other elements of the bailout package that, you know, went to AIG, you know, went to all these, you know, the big Wall Street banks, and that's what most people really hated about the bailouts. The thing that really cheesed off Rick Santelli was the prospect of small borrowers getting off the hook. It's like a complete reversal of the sort of standard populist reaction to hard times.
Tom Frank, our guest today on Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, coming to you live again, so phone calls are welcome. Call in if you'd like to chat with Tom Frank, author of the new book, which we're talking about, Pity the Billionaire, just out with Metropolitan Books. And Tom, one of the things that was interesting to me, Santelli's rant was shortly after the Obama administration came into power, and almost immediately, I mean, literally, it seemed like within days of Obama becoming president of the United States, there was this visceral hatred of him and of Democrats in general, but especially of Obama, that from the Tea Party, that was, you know, astonishing. The guy, the honeymoon, heck, this guy didn't even get a shotgun glove compartment 10-second window. I mean, he was already the worst president ever before he had, you know, finished putting his hand down from taking the oath.
That's exactly right. I went to that first. So Santelli was a couple weeks after the inauguration, and the first Tea Party rally was about a week and a half after that. I mean, they put this movement together overnight, I mean, instantaneously. And I went to that first rally. It was in February of 2009. Obama hadn't even been president for a month. And I remember this chant that people kept yelling at this first Tea Party rally. We're mad as hell. We're not going to take it anymore. And, you know, from that movie, from the 70s Network.
Sure.
And it's funny because it is sort of like, you know, through the funhouse media mirror here. But they start chanting this. And I was thinking, they're not going to take it anymore? The guy has only been hasn't even been president for a month. And already it's like, you know, a century of despair, you know?
But, you know, as you talk about in the book, Tom Frank, a lot of this, from what you show, is that the Tea Party movement sort of did an instant revision of recent American history and completely rewrote the role of Republicans and conservatives so that everything bad suddenly became the property of Obama and the Democrats, regardless of the fact that they hadn't been in power.
That's right. And of course, everybody would like to be able to do things like that, but these guys actually got away with it, which is extraordinary to me. And so, you know, for example, the bailouts were initially done by the Bush administration, a conservative Republican administration, acting through its conservative Republican Secretary of the Treasury, Hank Paulson. That's who came up with this plan and this idea and put it into effect. And the response of the Tea Party movement is simply to say, oh, well, you know, those guys aren't real conservatives. So, you know, we hereby expel them from the movement. And that's it. It's just, you know, no sooner said than done.
They're
know?
Honorary Democrats at that point.
They just get away with that. And so bailouts are automatically, according to their definition, an act of liberalism because they are a form of state intervention in the economy. And, you know, this is not going to surprise you, Bob, but if you look very deeply into the history of bailouts, you find conservatives and Republicans, you know, engaging in bailouts, you know, throughout history. It happens all the time. Ronald Reagan bailed out Continental Illinois, which was the biggest bank failure up until then, the biggest bank failure in American history. Walter Wriston, the head of Citibank. And by the way, one of the sort of great, you know, original thinkers in the development of you know, our modern-day cult of markets, Walter Wriston. Citibank got bailouts under his watch. He was happy to take them. You know, mm-hmm. Herbert Hoover bailed out banks. And the man that did it for Hoover had been, you know, who he put in charge of the bailout organization was Calvin Coolidge's vice president. They do it all the time. You know, and yet we're supposed to say, you know, we're supposed to believe that because, you know, they don't like these bailouts, the bailouts were terrifically unpopular, that they can just say, you know, nope, this is not conservatism. Real conservatism would never do this. You know, we aren't guilty. Not our problem, you know. And you look at these guys on the campaign trail, and they all seem to, this is, you know, they all seem to think that, well, and people go out there and vote for them. This is an argument that is compelling to people.
You address this issue in the book, and it sort of came back to me during the last 2 weeks in the Republican presidential debates in Iowa and New Hampshire, which is the question of how much the element of white racism is in the Tea Party movement and on the right. And I think your initial answer in the book, and I wonder if it's changed, is that we shouldn't exaggerate this, that there might be an element of it, but it's not really, you know, it's a much deeper phenomenon than one that can be explained by white racism, although that might be a factor in the antipathy toward President Obama specifically.
I think it almost certainly is a factor. And you did see, I mean, there's several really spectacular instances of racism in the Tea Party. In fact, one of the funniest—I mean, funny in the sense of just so stupid—one of the worst outbreaks of that was actually in response to an NAACP resolution criticizing the Tea Party for sometimes, you know, for sometimes being racist. And some Tea Party leader wrote this, you know, in sort of insane response to the NAACP. You know, it was so wrong in so many ways. But on the other hand, these people also loved Herman Cain, you know. Mm-hmm. They're still really sad that he's not going to be their presidential candidate.
But how much time was it that Herman Cain was, as long as he was the black guy, said there was no racism in America, they loved him. But remember that one time
that? I missed that.
Well, in effect, he says that if blacks aren't doing well, it's their own fault. And, you know, because remember the one time he sort of was remotely critical of Rick Perry for the N-Head Ranch?
Oh, yes, I remember that.
He got crapped on immediately. He backed down instantly.
I see. Now you know more about that than me. I don't remember. I thought he was kind of I thought that was pretty cool of him to stand up to Rick Perry like that.
No, but as soon as he heard from the rest of the Republican Party, wait, you're not supposed to be talking like that, he clammed up on that issue instantly.
Okay.
So I think his role was basically the guy who was...
Look, there's no doubt about it, but the main thing is that, you know, when you go to their rallies, you almost never hear... they aren't making an overt racist appeal.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's not what they're doing. They're making this other appeal in, you know, in really, really loud terms.
Mm-hmm.
I think it would be a mistake to prioritize, you know, something that they almost never say over something that they say constantly, even though that thing that they almost never say may well be, you know, a really important motivation, you know, something that is truly motivating them. And look, there's, you know, their reaction to President Obama is so just off the charts. you know, the way they talk about him is, you know, the terminology that they always come back to is that he's alien in some way. Mm-hmm. We don't know where he's born. Is he really an American? I think he's from Kenya. He's a communist. He's a socialist. I mean, he's a Nazi too.
I mean,
Hitler clothes.
Yeah.
You know, but it always comes back to him being alien. You know, he's too smart. You know, he's some kind of intellectual. I forget who. There's one analogy I read that was particularly loathsome. I forget who said it. I should look it up. But they were saying, whoever this was saying that he was like you know, an alien object in a human body, and it has to be expelled. And America will, you know, expel him because he's this alien sort of, like an infection or something. It's just disgusting.
No, that's very creepy.
Yeah.
Our guest today, Tom Frank, author of the new book, Pity the Billionaire. Phone lines are open at 217-333-9455. Toll-free line is open at 1-800-222-9455. Let's go to our first caller, line one. Urbana, you're on the air with Tom Frank.
Hello. My attention was diverted, but I think you said that the brokers and the major traders are parasites. And I certainly agree with that. As you remember, the flash crash a year ago when the Dow dropped 1,000 points, that, in my opinion, was a collusion of the big traders to reap the failure of the public traders, because they got together, as they always do, and they saw where the stops are. In other words, for people who don't know what a stop is, like say you bought Ajax stock at 20 and you put in a sell stop at 13 just in case, like you're at work and you can't see the market, you figure, well, if the stock goes down to 13, then something drastically must have happened. It could fall further, so I better put my stop in there. And they ran it right down. They ran the stops. They bought the stuff, and then they took it back up. And as proof of that, one proof would be that it's an opaque process. It's not like a baseball game in which you see every out and inning, and you don't see who traded what.
Yeah, that's for sure.
And therefore, when it went down, and it goes back up, you have to take their word for it.
Yeah, yeah. And you got sold out, meanwhile.
Yeah, really.
Because you put in your stop order. Yeah, I see what you're saying. Yeah, look, the parasites line is not – I probably wouldn't go that far, but that was one of the subjects that I used to study back when I was a graduate student and wanted to be an academic was, you know, I wanted to be a historian. But and I used to study 19th century populism, and they used the language of producers and parasites all the time, the idea being that farmers and workers were producers, and that the people in the financial world were essentially parasites who did nothing, you know, who just moved money from one pocket to another. And but that's not. I don't think I would go that far. I'm always reluctant to use imagery like that. But what's amusing to me is that imagery has come back in a huge way, being used by the right, you know, in their own version of populism. In particular, I'm thinking of the Ayn Rand image of where it's the exact opposite, where the great capitalists are the producers, and the rest of us, farmers, workers, you know, everybody that does anything, we're parasites, looters and moochers, you know, who can't pull our own weight, and everything that we have is basically a gift to us from these great geniuses.
Actually, Tom, I was just listening to one of the Republican debates and watching the coverage in the last week, and it was striking that both Mitt Romney and Rick Santorum, and I think they're really echoing the opinions that are probably held by and large among all the major candidates, but those two specifically I heard say this, they actually reframed it less in terms of just the financiers and those at the very top are the producers, but rather, you know, they try to link up working and middle class and upper classes all being common ground. They're the producers. And then everyone is poor and not working as a parasite.
That's right. Or they would say, you know, the job creators or something. They use that language of the job creators all the time. In fact, because look, you can't run for the presidency by saying the kind of things that Ayn Rand says, that, you know, that there's only like 100 worthwhile people in America. You know, that's
hey, let me back
you
up.
Win an election saying things like that.
Tom Frank, let me back you up, because I suspect we have a number of listeners who may have heard the name Ayn Rand, but really have never read her, not familiar with her. And she does play a role in the Tea Party as sort of a matron saint. Can you give a little background on who she was, what she argued, and why she's so prominent?
Yeah, sure. She's a novelist who worked in the middle of the 20th century and wrote two novels that were both very, very long and are still very widely read, Atlas Shrugged and The Fountainhead. And Atlas Shrugged in particular is a novel that the Tea Party movement and the conservative right in general has taken up as their favorite work of fiction. It's really, really long, and it's the story of a strike by by tycoons, by billionaires, and they bring the economy to its knees by withholding their genius from it. It's a favorite book of the Tea Party movement. Bob, you're there in Wisconsin. I remember several members of your state's delegation to Congress have cited it as like the greatest work of fiction of all time, or something like this. Do you know who I'm talking about?
Not offhand, but I suspect there are a lot of people in Wisconsin and Illinois who feel the same way.
Yeah, I went down, new members of Congress, and there's a great number of them that have talked about how wonderful Ayn Rand is. But she basically takes all of your old sort of populist categories and ways of looking at the world and flips them on their head. And, it's a fascinating – she's kind of a – I don't know if you ever read Friedrich Nietzsche. He's the philosopher of, his idea of the Superman. You have these individuals who are just so much smarter and more creative and, more all-around wonderful than everybody else. And she takes that idea and sort of domesticates it, applies it to capitalism. And it's kind of a monstrous social system that she comes up with. I mean, it is monstrous. It's appalling. And when I read Atlas Shrugged in order to write Pity the Billionaire, and it's really disturbing and really unsettling. And the Tea Party loves this book. You go to their rallies and they hold signs with Ayn Rand's picture on it. They love to quote these famous passages from the novel. But, I talk about this too much, but let me just say, my interpretation of it in one sentence. It's a book about, in my view, the Great Depression as, in a sort of counterfactual way. It's the Great Depression as if it happened according to sort of laissez-faire conservative theory. It's fascinating stuff.
Our guest, Tom Frank, author of Pity the Billionaire. We have a full bank of callers wanting to talk with Tom Frank, so we're going to go to them forthwith. The number, if you want to join them, 217-333-9455. Let's go back to the phone lines right now. Line 2, Eau Claire, Wisconsin. You're on the air with Thomas Frank.
Good afternoon. The congressman in question is Ryan from Janesville, Wisconsin.
Yeah.
With big business, Paul Ryan.
Yeah, Paul Ryan.
But you also have a U.S. Senator.
Ron Johnson.
Yes, he's brand new, and he often talks about how great Ayn Rand is.
Mm-hmm. Well, they both have a distorted perception of reality. Anyway, the question I have for you is due to the fact that, or maybe you'd like to comment on this, in my opinion, the country in general, politically speaking, has drifted so far to the right that anyone who calls himself even a moderate is, let's say, compared to where things were 40 years ago, someone who would be a liberal moderate would have been 40 years ago far to the right of center. As an example, in this day and age, I can't imagine Richard Nixon or Gerald Ford being able to run for president because they weren't far enough to the right. I mean, they weren't conservative enough, or for that matter, Everett Dirksen, especially when people would drag up the Civil Rights Bill of 1965 was drafted in your office. Well, you're a liberal commie. We can't.
Yeah, yeah. Well, how about Bob Dole? I mean, Bob Dole could get elected
Dole.
In Kansas today.
Yep. And Nixon, he would have been. You supported the formation of the EPA. Well, we can't have you. So, comment on it, please, because I think that the real problem in our politics is things have drifted so far to the right, they keep drifting to the right, and I think we're going to keep drifting to the right until we sink. It's just
oh my God. Well, you're getting at the subject close to my heart. Thank you, caller.
And Tom, as you answer that, can I interject? And I think this gets to the point of, you know, what about the Democrats? Because where do they fit into this whole picture in both Tea Party lore and in reality?
And why haven't they been able to stop this?
Yeah.
Well, I mean, this is the caller has posed the great question, and that's what my last three books have been about. And I'll tell you, Bob, after the Wrecking Crew, which is about conservative D.C., the subtitle was How Conservatives Rule, and you know, it was about the Bush administration and the Reagan administration and how they run the government. And after I wrote that, I was sick of writing about conservatism. I didn't want to look at this anymore. It's such a depressing thing how you know, they keep winning, and even when they lose and their leaders go to jail like Jack Abramoff, you know, they're right back. But I had to do it. I had to. I mean, then the Tea Party movement came along and the great shift to the right of 2010, and I had to get back in the saddle and start working on this subject again. And you know, it's. That's what all of these books are about, how they keep doing it. But we'll probably talk about that for the rest of the hour, but right now it is time to say one of the big reasons that they do it. I mean, we can talk about how they've harnessed populist energy, how they organize discontent, how they, you know, they have this utopian ideology. These are all points that I raise in the book, how they speak to people's anger about bailouts and the financial crisis. But the main thing is, or one of the factors that we always have to remember is the Democrats have allowed this to happen. The other party has allowed this to happen. They have not been able to beat these guys, and this has been going on. You know, when Richard Nixon was elected in '68, he was regarded as conservative, and it was regarded as a big election, a big shift, movement to the right, and we've kept moving to the right ever since. And the Democrats now have had, what is that? Is that 40 years? That's we're getting close to it being 50 years since that. And they still haven't figured out how to stop this thing. And all of those conservative victories have been more or less populist victories. You know, Richard Nixon and the silent majority, you know, right down to our own day, where you know, these people talking about taking back America and rallying in the park with their bullhorns and their three-cornered hats. And Democrats just sort of are like, you know, bystanders. They cannot figure out how to beat this thing, how to short-circuit it, how to challenge it in a meaningful way. And, I mean, that's a failure that is just as dramatic as the sort of, the ingeniousness of the right. And I know that's not an answer.
Well, I mean,
I'll keep going if you want me to.
No, I'll tell you what, we've got callers waiting. Let's let them participate in this conversation. Let's now go to line 4, Coles County. Thank you for your patience. Yes. You're on the air with Tom Frank.
Yes, I find it to be just unbelievable and outrageous that these people call Obama a socialist when he has bailed out American capitalism, much of American capitalism and business being bailed out by Obama. If he had done just the opposite and refused to bail out American business, industry, and American capitalism, I could see why they might make the allegation that he is a socialist.
No, that's funny.
I don't understand how anybody can be stupid enough to see that the bailouts are proof of just the opposite, that he isn't a socialist.
But you know what's funny about that? That's a really good point. And I think I've talked to you about this, Bob, in a private conversation before.
Mm-hmm.
The whole idea that bailouts are a form of socialism is this media kind of theme that got off the ground right at the start, right when the bailouts were happening. And one of the main culprits in this was actually Newsweek magazine.
I remember that.
Cover story. Right about the time of the first Tea Party rally, they had a cover story that said the cover of Newsweek said, "We are all socialists now." And it was referring to the bailouts, that the bailouts were an act of socialism. And, you know, this was, in my view, a preposterous misrepresentation. I actually know people who are socialists. The bailouts infuriated them. You know, I'm pretty far to the left. I was infuriated by the bailouts. The idea that these banks should just be set right back up so that they can go back to doing what they were doing before, that they don't get punished in any way. Oh, my God. You know, to think that's socialist in the sense of, but they also depicted when, you know, when a bank is insolvent and the government steps in. This is not Newsweek per se. This was just in the culture, in the media, when the bailouts were going on. They would say that to take over a bank, an insolvent bank, which the FDIC does almost every day of the year, but to take over an insolvent bank and unwind its business is also an act of socialism. They kept calling this nationalization. So they'd say, you know, the government has nationalized this bank and that bank, when in fact what they mean was that the government had liquidated these banks, you know, that they were insolvent banks and the government had stepped in and unwound them. And that's another sort of perversion of the language, but that it largely went unchallenged. So that this, you know, sort of the everyday operations of the courts and the FDIC was supposed to be this kind of wacko left-wing thing, like when the, you know, British took over the coal mines after World War II, or the steel industry, you know, when they actually nationalized industries. But that sort of thing just went completely unchallenged.
Let's go back to the phone lines right now. We have a caller from the Netherlands on line one who's been waiting patiently. Let's go to line one now. Netherlands, you're on the air with Tom Frank.
Yeah, good evening.
Good evening.
It's afternoon in America. I'm sorry.
You're forgiven.
Yeah, I'm a big fan of your writing, Mr. Frank. And I guess I'm happy that you've gone from the Wall Street Journal because of that, because the last time you were on Media Matters, you said you were so busy writing for the Wall Street Journal that you had no time to write a new book.
Well, that's true, yes.
But this does raise a question, which is, why are you gone from the Wall Street Journal? Is there still room for a voice like yours under Rupert Murdoch ownership? I'll answer off the air.
Yeah, okay. Thank you very much.
Yeah, I went to Harper's Magazine. It was a deliberate choice that I made.
But Tom, there's always been a tradition, at least in the last few decades, of the Wall Street Journal having one sort of person, not just a liberal, but even to the left of liberal, you yourself, Alexander Coburn before you.
Yes.
Is there someone holding down that fort now?
Last time I checked, there was not.
Yeah, that's...
The Wall Street Journal does run op-eds by liberals. They do it all the time.
Yeah.
I was their regular I was the only one of their regular columnists who was a liberal, and I was proud to do it. It was let me just say this, it was a tough job. That was a really hard, hard job. And I was proud to do it, but it kept me real busy. But, you know, I wouldn't have paid such close attention to the financial crisis and the Tea Party movement if I hadn't had that job. So I have them to thank for this book, although it's what the caller said is true. It would have been really hard to write this book if I was still doing a weekly column.
Tom, before we get back to the next two callers who are waiting patiently, who I will get to shortly, there's one part of the book that's very important to your whole argument, and I think to understanding the Tea Party. We haven't talked about it all, and I do want you to talk briefly about it, which is the role of Fox News specifically, right-wing media in general, back also, in sort of being the megaphone of this movement and really giving it legs that would have made the movement much more difficult if it didn't exist.
Okay. Yeah, Fox News is absolutely critical in the rise of the movement of everything to the right. These guys are very critical, and especially Glenn Beck. When you go to Tea Party rallies, or in the old days when you go to Tea Party rallies, or when you read Tea Party books, or when you listen to interviews with Tea Party people, they reiterate things that they heard on the Glenn Beck program. Glenn Beck became kind of the what would you say? He was like that's Tea Party orthodoxy. It all issued from him. He was the guru.
Nostradamus.
Yeah. but he had, you know, he had these very curious historical interpretations. He hadn't made them up himself, but they were, you know, sort of taken from the fringes of academia and from, you know, like Birch Society authors and that kind of thing. And he popularized these, you know, things that you would have never heard of otherwise. And he popularized them, but popularize is too weak a word. He made these things common sense of this movement. But it's the influence of, and we can talk about him more as we go on, but the influence of Fox News. The other thing is that Fox News allows people to basically tune out the rest of the world. Mm-hmm. You know, you don't have to read a newspaper. You can watch Fox News, and they will give you essentially sort of interlocking ideological explanation of everything. And in that sense, it's very similar to sort of, being a part of, like an extremist political movement 80 years ago. It furnishes you with this sort of ready-made ideology. And it's not just Fox News, but it's also, the Internet. This is well known that in sociological circles that, the nation is what they call self-segregating. People are withdrawing into neighborhoods where everybody is just like them. They only read news that they agree with, but I think that hard times made this kind of sort of extreme ideological worldview. I shouldn't use the word extreme; it's not a convincing term. This kind of utopian way of looking at the world made it much more attractive to people.
Mm-hmm.
And now I'm not okay. Shall I tell you here's how this came to me. Okay, this is actually much more interesting than I'm making it sound. Okay, you know this, Bob, because you know me. I spend a lot of my time reading literature from the 1930s. This is what I do. I love reading about the 1930s. And one of the constant themes in historical accounts of that period is the sort of the dogmatism of people on the left, especially. Like, you think of the members of the American Communist Party who would go over to the Soviet Union and would, think everything was going great in the Soviet Union in the 1930s, someone would tell them about, like, the famine in the Ukraine or something, and they would brush it off. They would, they would be able to don these kind of ideological glasses, and they would see nothing. Mm-hmm. There's many, many examples of this. It's kind of a set piece of a certain kind of cultural history.
Yeah, all of Stalin's show trials, all that stuff.
Yeah, that's right. And eventually they all get disabused of this notion when you have the show trials and then the Hitler-Stalin pact, that kind of thing. And it's a great surprise to them to learn that the world, this worldview that they have accepted and that they have sort of deliberately instructed themselves in turns out to be completely wrong, okay? And it's a psychological phenomenon. There was a term that the sociologists used to use for this. They called it, what is it, the social construction of reality. There's a famous book on it from the 1930s called Ideology and Utopia by Carl Mannheim. And this was, it is a fascinating subject, but it's a phenomenon of hard times. And this is exactly what is going on the right today. They have their own world of facts and myths and ways of interpreting things, and it's actually been easy for them to say, the great mistake that we've made in America is that we didn't deregulate enough. We just never went all the way with our free markets. There was still government here and there, so therefore the free market, our great sort of theoretical worship object, the free market is never to blame for anything, because there still was government. There still was Fannie and Freddie, There still were bailouts. So therefore, we just, it's not that the experiment failed. Our experiment with deregulation and 40 years of conservatism, that didn't fail. We just never went far enough.
Our guest, Tom Frank, author of Pity the Billionaire, just out from Metropolitan Books. Tom Frank writes for Harper's, the author of many other books, including The Wrecking Crew and What's the Matter with Kansas. We have two callers who have been waiting what seems like forever. Let's go to them starting right now. Let's see what... I'm a little confused about where we are on the lines. I guess we're going to go to the next caller, and I assume this is line for London, but I'm not sure. So I'll take whoever the producer generates.
Hello.
Hello. Yes, you're on the air. Who are you?
Yes, I'm from London, and I have a simple question for Mr. Thomas Frank. And why is it that in his analysis he doesn't refer to the Israel lobby, after Mersheimer and Walt? One would say that would be an important thing to analyze. And why is that missing? Thanks.
Well, thank you very much, Carl.
Well, the answer is, of course, I'm part of it. No, I'm sorry. I'm kidding. The book isn't about foreign policy. It's not my subject. Although, you know, I do have my opinions on...
Well, actually, though, there is an interesting part to the story here that gets to, although that's not what the call is necessarily about, which is the conservatives who embraced the Tea Party. Michelle Bachmann comes to mind, who sort of embraced it, you know, most vociferously, have embraced the cause of Israel as being arguably the most important cause in the world.
Yeah, I'm not up to speed on that subject. It's just I've never really been interested in the Middle East, except for, you know, when we were starting a war with Iraq for no good reason. You know, that obviously made me pretty angry back in 2003. But I'm just not up to speed on this. I'm sorry. I write about domestic politics.
No, that's quite all right. And we're going to go back to two callers who've been waiting very patiently right now. Let's go right now to line three, Chicago. You're on the air with Tom Frank.
Good afternoon, gentlemen.
Good afternoon.
And, hey, Tom, I'm a big Baffler fan from back in the day. I met you about 10 years ago in Chicago. So I have a question for you. I am one of those who thinks that both sides, quote unquote, in our ideological debate, have good points. I think the libertarians who are kind of emerging are right in that we do have too much government that doesn't really do much of any good, and it does tax, regulate, and you know, just mess with small business, you know, too much. We're supposed to be helping small business, but you know, they're getting in the way and they're bailing out big guys, and so that's not right. I also, of course, agree with the progressives. There's too much wealth concentration, but I don't see it as, you know, big government versus big business. I see them as kind of both in bed together.
Oh, that's totally correct.
Yeah. I wanted to ask you, in the course of your research, have you come across the name Henry George very much? Because
Henry George, do you mean the single taxer?
Yes, sir.
Yeah. Well, in my research on the 1890s, I used to come across him all the time. He was huge in the late 19th century. He was a reformer, and I don't really remember the particulars of his idea of government. But what the single tax was a property tax, if I remember right. Is that right?
Right.
It
specifically land. He kind of called himself. He was in the mold of Jeffersonian democracy. And he said, basically, well, we do want a limited government. We don't want government to interfering too much in our affairs. But, however, we do need a distribution of wealth that's just. And his way of doing this was, you know, you don't attack capital because, you know, capital is, you know, it's really, it ought to be just the tools of labor. But he said the monopoly comes from land monopoly.
Yeah,
it's a little bit involved to get into here.
Yeah, I remember never being able to really understand the Henry George phenomenon, and I mean that's probably because I was looking at this, you know, nowadays, and I think it was very, very compelling to people, you know, 120 years ago, and today it's kind of hard to understand. But as many of the sort of the great reform ideas of that period are. But look, to get back to what you said about small business and then giant business. This is, you know, this is really, you're getting very close to the heart of the question here. And one of the things that I discovered, I mean, the Tea Party movement is very much a movement of small business people. And many of them say, you know, have a line very similar to what you just described. You know, how can you say that that we've been deregulating and we've been doing and we've been rolling back the state when the government gets into my mix every day? You know, and I have to fill out these enormous tax forms every year and comply with these EPA things. And there's a lot of truth to that. The fact is that the regulatory state weighs much more heavily on small business than it does on big business. I mean, that's just the fact. That's the way it is. But the other side of this coin is that small business is almost always in our politics is used as a kind of facade or a kind of front for big business interests, and that's what's happening again this time around. But you know, I've always been very sympathetic to small business. I think we all are. I always try to patronize local businesses rather than chain stores. And, you know, the people that I grew up around were all small businessmen. So I'm, you know, I'm very sympathetic to them. But then on the, you know, there's, you always, I'm always just completely puzzled at the Democrats and the liberals' failure to speak to small business owners. You know, they're turning against Obama, for example, in these huge numbers. And why is that? There's no reason why. I mean, there used to be. I'm sorry. Take a step back. Small business people used to be part of the progressive coalition a long time ago. And the reason for that was because progressives were the ones who enforced antitrust laws. The antitrust laws were written, you know, to help out small business, to restore, you know, sort of a fair marketplace. And we don't bother with that anymore, except for, you know, here and there we enforce them, you know, every now and then. But we don't even bother. So there's both some validity to what you say, and there's also a lot of, you know, there's also in the larger conversation about small business, there is a, you know, a lot of misdirection, I think.
Let's go to our final caller, if we can, now for the show today. Maybe final caller, maybe get another one, and we'll see. Line 2, Peoria, you're on the air.
Hello. I wondered if he saw, if Thomas Frank saw Mitt Romney's defense of corporations as people. He was addressing.
Yeah. I love it.
He was, you know, pressed white shirt and blue jeans, and it sounded like a high school junior achievement report on corporations.
Not only did I see it, I was just I was working on an essay about Romney the other day, and I came across a website where they were where it's actually a website dedicated to the memory of Calvin Coolidge, and on this website they said, you know, the other day Romney said correctly that corporations are people, and this is something that I a long time ago I came up with the a way of describing the ideology of our time is market populism, the idea that markets speak with the vox populi, with the voice of the people, and that corporations are, you know, are sort of human, that corporations are in some ways more human than us. And this is a trend that I traced through the sort of management theory in the 1990s. You used to see this idea everywhere. And when I start talking about it in that sense, it sounds ridiculous. It is ridiculous. It's a preposterous idea, and yet here you've got, you know, Mitt Romney, who started out as a management consultant. Of course, he thinks corporations are people. It's just beautiful, though. You know, after the greatest economic collapse that most of us will ever see in our lifetimes, we're going to. I mean. Romney's going to give Obama a run for his money. There's no question about it. And you know, if he wins, we're going to have elected a man to the president whose reaction to the greatest corporate debacle of all time is to declare that corporations are people. Corporations are people too, Bob.
Yeah, Tom Frank, we've only got a minute or so left. One question, we could do a whole show on this, but you finished the book, I think, almost precisely as the Occupy Wall Street movement started blasting off and getting attention. In the fall of 2011, and I'm wondering if you were to go back right now and do a follow-up for a paperback edition, would that change how you write the book?
Well, it might. The thing is that we haven't had enough time. I was, you know, Occupy hasn't been around long enough. It hasn't had an impact yet, in the way that the Tea Party movement has, or that the great shift to the right. I don't know what you want to call it, but the 2010 phenomenon has had this enormous impact. If Occupy takes off next year and starts, you know, we'll see. I don't know where the movement is going to go from here. You know, it's got to become something bigger than, you know, people camping out. It's got to. And I hope it does. But, you know, there were other movements. I came out to Madison and wrote about the people protesting Scott Walker. And that,
you know,
was
what,
there.
Tom Frank, on that note, I hear the band tuning up in the background. That
Uh-oh.
Means, unfortunately, they want to clear me out of the studio.
Okay. All right, Bob.
Tom Frank, author of Pity the Billionaire, thank you so much for joining us today on Media Matters. And I want to thank Christina Williams, my producer, Kyle Kroha, the engineer, for their great work. I'm Bob McChesney. I'll be back in 167 hours with another show. Everyone have a great week.
Today's broadcast is made possible with support from Mike Weaver Ballroom Dance. Private instruction for social or competitive dancing, weddings, or other special events. Lessons for singles or couples, beginners or advanced of all ages. Information at 378-4601 or on your web, search at Mike Weaver Ballroom Dance.
Partly sunny skies in our weather forecast today. Expect a high of near 45. Mostly cloudy tonight, the low 28. Sunny tomorrow, the high 48. Mostly clear tomorrow night, the low of 32. And for Tuesday, sunny again, the high 52. This is Illinois Public Media, WILL, 580 AM and